as a species, we are both remarkably robust and noteworthily fragile. Let's just think about this in terms of climate and where we live, if we're here in Winnipeg when we're watching this. We get temperatures ranging from, you know, conservatively from minus 40 to plus 40. That's a pretty big range. We have precipitation of almost every kind at almost any time of the year. We have bugs. Let's not talk about bugs right now. We're just coming into the golden season, right? Where the sunshine is warm, but the bugs aren't awake yet. They're all still huddled up in their sleeping bags waiting for it to get warmer. So let's just carry on. We live here. And although we might complain about variations of some of those things that I just listed, humans have managed to thrive here from long before any records were kept. So from that perspective, we could say we're pretty durable. And yet it doesn't take much to undo us. These are very general numbers, and there are all kinds of exceptions, most of which make interesting stories. But broadly speaking, we can go for about 3 minutes without oxygen. We can go for about 3 days without water. And we can go for about 3 weeks without food. And there are limits on how long we can go with things like, you know, without sunshine, without sleep, that kind of stuff as well. Now, I'm grateful to say that I have very limited experience when it comes to going without food, more often by choice than not, but I can clearly remember a childhood experience of going without oxygen when I crashed my bike and the bar end got me squarely in the solar plexus. You know, I'd heard about being winded before from maybe my more athletic buddies or whatever, and I'm like, yeah, you got the breath knocked out of you, just take a breath, right? I'd never had that experience of everything inside of me is screaming for oxygen and my body can't do it. It cannot physically do it right now. I was about 10 years old when that happened. And although the street where it happened, I think, has since been, you know, paved over and turned into, a car sales place or something in my hometown. If that street still existed, I think I could go right there and show you the chunk of pavement. I mean, it's not being able to breathe even for a few moments is an awful feeling. I do understand and I can appreciate how even talking about this can be difficult for some of us for a variety of reasons, including anxiety-related challenges that make it hard to feel as though we can really get a deep breath. So I'm going to move on to water. I feel like an incredibly fortunate person in that I've been able to have many adventures in my life. And one of those was an extended time backpacking in the desert in Utah. And this was one of those situations where water resupply was not an environmental option. Whatever water you carried in was what you had to work with for the duration. Water, most of us don't have to carry it around, but if we do, we know quickly that water is heavy stuff. And so we were backpacking, so we had done the math as thoroughly as possible. We had thought we had enough for our several day trek. But then, those words are the harbinger of trouble, right? But then we got slowed down by, of all things, a snowstorm, a desert blizzard. And one thing led to another, and we were a day late getting out. And we'd built in a little bit of, you know, water buffer. So we all started that last day hiking out with some water in our bottles. But despite being very conservative with my personal water intake, mine was gone by midday and early afternoon, somewhere in there. And I was at that point hiking on my own. And so the only real option was going without water. And by now the snow was long gone and it was sunny. It was hot. It was very dry. And by mid-afternoon, I was starting to feel the effects of dehydration. I was feeling physically wobbly. I had a headache. My vision was starting to get blurry. I was experiencing some nausea. And I knew what was going on, but there weren't really a lot of options. And so I knew I probably had another 4 hours or so to go to get to the trailhead and to a water resupply. And I was honestly starting to wonder if I was going to make it. And then I came around a corner in the trail and there were some other people. And it turns out that the trail that I was on intersected with a short hike into an easily accessed viewpoint over a canyon. And there was a group of folks who had made the relatively short hike in to see that view. And they had water. Now, I just want you to know, this was a long time ago. I was an immortal 20-something, right? I was very fit. I was in a program that trained wilderness guides. I was a wannabe hard-ass outdoors guy. That's what was going on at that point in my life. And really, I was sort of an elite in training when it came to being a skilled person in the outdoors. And here I was, staggering along like a muddle-headed drunk person because I had miscalculated something as basic as having enough water. Yeah, so here's the question that I had to answer at that point. Was I just going to put my head down and kind of wave to those wimps that just did the short hike in from the parking lot and blast through like the super hiker that I wanted to be? Or was I going to ask for water like the novice, you know, didn't do my homework adequately desert hiker that I actually was? Maybe I've never adequately processed that experience. I know that I'd never tried to write it down before last week when I was writing this. But I think that moment touched a pretty deep spot in me somehow, because as I was writing this down earlier in the week, and I had a big glass of water sitting on my desk within arm's reach, and as I was writing this, I started to tear up. And I didn't really have any other strong emotions, despite I took some time to check in with myself. Just kind of go, what, you know, what's this about? Just a little bit of a swell of something that suggested that this moment resides in a significant space for me. Both Judy and Ariel, who, among other things, counsel people as part of their work, like to say that our emotions are not there just to make us miserable, which I always think is a really a funny way to talk about it in a good sense. They're not just there to make us miserable, they're there to tell us something. And this story may have more to teach me than it already has. That's for me to attend to. For now, though, I'm going to tell you what happened in the moment. So my path took me past a guy in the other group. And as I approached him, he said something like, "How you doing?" And I expect he was just being polite, but that was just the opening my fragile ego needed. And I said, you know, "Pretty good," which is not strictly true, but it's sort of a stock answer. "Pretty good, but I'm out of water and I got a few hours to go. Anybody in your group that could spare a bit?" You know, so I can kind of leave the story open, right? Why is he out of water, man? Maybe he's been like through hiking for months and, you know, he only needs 2 tablespoons, but they're gone. Or maybe he's an idiot and he just didn't bring any water today, like everything in between. I'm not defining my problem, but I'm admitting to it a little bit, right? So basically on the outside, no matter what I'm saying, on the inside, I'm saying, I'm not sure I can get myself out of this situation that I got myself into and I need a helping hand. Well, ouch, right? At least for me, at that point, it was an ouch to own that. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever had one of those moments where you just do something really ungainly, like you slip on a patch of ice in the superstore parking lot, you land flat on your butt, and you know, once the birdies stop swirling and chirping from the impact, you look around to see if anybody else like noticed what happened. Well, this sort of felt like that to me. It's kind of like I could really use some help here, and I know it, but I'm okay if the rest of the world doesn't know about my situation. You know, I'm all right if everybody doesn't know that I need some help. I think I was just sort of hoping for a quiet, "Hey, no problem, man," and you know, a bottle of water. But no. They had lots of water, and I got my refill. I chugged down half of it. I immediately started to recover. But it did involve a bit of group discussion, just to make sure they all had enough as well. And so by the time we got it all sorted, you know, everybody in their group knew my story. And it was like the universe was saying, "I know you think what you need is water, but what you really need is to get over yourself and to step beyond whatever it is you're afraid will happen if you acknowledge what you're really experiencing and just ask for some help." Oh, man. Anyway, I would love to report lesson learned. But the truth would be that it seems to be an ongoing project. I suspect that although the details will differ, that experience of finding ourselves coming up a bit short on the needed resources and feeling some reservations about admitting that aren't all that rare. One of the places I feel like I see it occur fairly often is a big part of why I believe it's essential for communities like The Table to exist. General trends are well established. people are abandoning the religions that they grew up with, grew up in by the millions. And if you've been around the table for any length of time, you know that I believe that those stats reflect a complex blend of difficult news and good news. Difficult news, perhaps especially if you are of the conviction that one particular set of beliefs is the only true way forward for all of humanity, as a church sign that I pass regularly suggests. Under that sort of worldview, the abandonment of whichever religion you believe is the true one spells the death knell, you know, for humanity. It's the beginning of the end, with the exception of the true believers who are going to be swept away before the fur really hits the fan or somehow otherwise sort of preserved in the end. If you grew up around Bible stories, you know that if you throw a rock at the Old Testament, you're probably going to hit a story, the outline of which goes something like, we're teetering on the brink of utter destruction, and the reason that's the case is because we didn't do what God told us to, and so unless we get it sorted and believe and do the right thing, by which the story usually means whatever the religious authorities say we ought to do, whatever the rules are, unless we do that, we're going over the cliff into oblivion. There were lots of reasons why the tellers of those stories felt like oblivion was a real imminent danger. Like the end of them as individuals, the end of them as a people was a realistic fear. And these are the stories that got told over and over again to explain why they were in this fearsome situation. The curious thing is that those stories, as they're collected together in the First Testament, come one after another, and the people group they're about is still here. In any event, those kind of experiences tend to be on the difficult news side of the ledger. And I don't want to gloss this. I really don't. Leaving a religion or leaving some aspect of a particular religious belief you grew up with or been deeply engaged with, nurtured in the presence of, nurtured by, that is difficult. That is hard. It might come, you know, such an experience might come with genuine loss, with the loss of things that we really, really like and find really important, things like certainty, loss of sense of meaning, reduction in a sense, our sense of stability, our ability to explain what we're experiencing, loss of opportunity, loss of belonging, so on. So we might both long to explore and also feel afraid to do it. That can be super hard. Now, on the good news side is the other experiences that often come with that sort of stepping away or change of perspective. We might broadly characterize many of those experiences as the freedom to explore what we believe without the strictures of being told that we are somehow going astray or putting ourselves or our soul or our life in some kind of significant peril. Kind of the, you know, keep going down that path and you'll find yourself stumbling along in a spiritual desert with an empty water bottle and no resupply in sight and danger of falling by the wayside and being lost among the thorns and thistles. Sorry if that last part triggered anyone. Of course it's fair to say that exploring what we believe is not a risk-free venture. But it's a logical fallacy to flip that around and believe that not exploring what we believe somehow secures us or protects us from the dangers of being a human in an uncertain world. It's pretty hard to authentically explore without taking risks. Reducing the risks of exploring is one of the reasons why we do things like read novels or watch movies, so we can go to places, so we can brush up against circumstances and emotions, we can consider situations and beliefs and their implications without actually putting ourselves materially into harm's way. It's one of the functions of stories, and it always has been. And of course, this includes stories that comprise collections of sacred texts. This includes stories that have the shape of mythologies or of guiding narratives. A good story, by which I mean, among other things, an impactful story, has a way of talking about circumstances that may be nothing like our circumstances, but still somehow inviting us to see our unique experience inside of that narrative. This is one of the reasons why a story can be true without being factual. Really important distinction. That's why we can read or hear a story that has, for instance, things like talking animals in it, as in the Genesis stories in the Bible, or stories from other cultures. And we can encounter a story like that, and we can find a resonance there. We can find things there that strike us as deeply true. But that doesn't mean we walk away from the story and start expecting our dogs to talk back to us in full English sentences just because we talk to them in full English sentences. Yes, I just admitted to talking to my dog in full English sentences. Sometimes, when we go exploring, even when it's in the realm of stories, we can get in over our heads. Ever had to close your eyes in a movie, leave the room? Ever put the novel down and go, I don't know if I can keep going with that? Sometimes our best laid plans fall prey to, you know, but then something happened. And we find ourselves stumbling along alone and muddle-headed in a place we're not sure we have the resources for, and we need some assistance. And then we may need to make a choice. Are we just going to, you know, pick up the pace and see if we can bluster our way through? Are we just going to charge a little harder, hang on a little longer, trust that the path we're on already won't get any steeper or more demanding and that we're going to make it somehow? Listen, I've got this can function as an encouraging, empowering idea, of course. And hey, we might make it. I've got this can also be a smokescreen for delusional thinking. It can be a truism that obscures the fact that we don't got this, and that continuing on without acknowledging our limitations, our wobbliness, our need for some resupply, for encouragement and support, that can be the path to a lonely place, even if we do manage to make it through. Listen, exploring what we believe can be exhilarating. It can also be disorienting, energy-sapping, and fear-inducing. Exploring what we believe often, and in a setting like the table, quite consistently, takes us into the realm of, among other things, religious beliefs. And there is a linkage between religion and fear that is not unique to any particular religion. It's one of the big levers that we tend to use when we're trying to bring people over to another point of view. And I want to probe that just a little bit and kind of leave some of that with us to think about on our own or to converse about later in our Zoom hang or with a friend or whatever. But on that last idea, fear-inducing experiences, I want to leave us with someone else's story that I've found instructive. This is from Brandon Stanton's book, Humans. Beautiful, beautiful book. You might be familiar with Brandon Stanton's photo blog, Humans of New York, which usually just goes by the acronym if you're looking it up, H-O-N-Y. This is Stanton's follow-up book. Same sort of mission, taking a picture of someone every day on the street and having them share a bit of their story, with their permission, obviously. But instead of just being in New York, in this book, he's traveled to over 40 countries and done that. And just a happy shout out to my sister Karen, who often joins us online from her home in Calgary. This was a family gift from Karen at Christmas, and it's been a wonderful way to do a little traveling during COVID. So thanks for that, Karen. Now, I chose a particular short story out of here, out of the hundreds that are in the book. And I chose this one because it touches uniquely on some of the ways that religious systems in particular can use fear to stop people from exploring, but it doesn't stop there. And so none of these characters have names. There's just a photograph of them. Here's the story. I grew up in Spain right after the Civil War. When I was 11, I was sent to a Catholic boarding school. And can I just interrupt briefly here to say, this is this person's story. I did not choose it for its details, but its themes. So I'm not on about something anti-Catholic here or anything like that. I just want to be very clear about that. When I was 11, I was sent to a Catholic boarding school. They fed me and sheltered me. But they only taught me religion. They were training me to be a priest. I was taught to fear God. I was taught to fear the outside world. I was taught to fear everything. I left the grounds one day when I was 28. I went to a barber shop and got my hair cut by a French woman. I'd never really spoken to a woman before. She told me I was cute. That same day, I bought a newspaper. It was the first time I'd ever bought something with my own money. When I returned to the school, I was changed. I had discovered freedom. I began to realize their lies, and so I wasn't useful to them anymore. A few months later, I met a woman in church and fell in love. We got married and had 3 children. I left all of it behind, except for the fear. Sometimes I still feel very afraid for no reason. That will always be a part of me. Amazing how much story you can pack into one paragraph, hey? I left it all behind except for the fear that will always be a part of me. The story strikes me as both hopeful and sad. And listen, I don't know any more about this person's story than what I read for all of us just now. I feel like I can identify with some of the ways in which fear can be used as a tool to keep us from exploring what we believe. I have my own story of how religious systems can use fear to keep people adhering, to keep them inside, to inhibit our inclination, our drive to explore. I have my own experiences of what it feels like to be moving along the path of exploring what I believe and then come to a place or have an experience where I feel like I'm afraid I don't have what it takes for the next steps. Or that I suspect I should be looking for or asking for a helping hand, but there are these messages inside of me that say, don't do that. You need to do this on your own. No, I don't need to do this on my own. And neither do you. The message of fear is not predicated on the kind of deep down truth for which we might use a word like love. If what we believe makes us afraid, if what we are being told to believe steers us away from the kind of community experiences where we can say things like, I could use a refill right about now, then maybe it's time to explore that. Just remember, we don't have to do it alone. Peace, everybody.